Today, instead of talking about the Galilean covariance of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, I decided we'd go, for a number of reasons, we'd go over to Boltzmann, talk about the arrow of time problem in the early days of the kinetic theory of gases and the emergence of statistical mechanics. But before I do that, I just wanted to make one or two remarks about the argument at the end of the last lecture concerning what some people refer to as Noether's third theorem. And this is the point that if you have a symmetry, which is a Noetherian symmetry, that's to say, a symmetry of the variational type, then if that symmetry is local, which means that it has as a subgroup, a certain subgroup of, say, global symmetries, the reason that you don't expect to see the usual conservation principles, the non-trivial conservation principles associated with the global symmetries, is that they are a subgroup of this wider local group, and it turns out that the vanishing of the divergence of the Noether current turns out to be trivial. Now, that I refer to as, well, I don't know if I mentioned it was Noether's third theorem, but that's what it's sometimes called. And as Jimmy and Dario pointed out last time, the argument that I gave wasn't really complete. So I just thought I'd give you an indication as to how this derivation goes very quickly. Just so you get a sense of the argument. Let's just take, for the case of simplicity, the case where the variation under our Noetherian transformations, the variation in the action, the first variation in the action actually is zero. So we're going to forget about some kind of surface term. Of course, you can always generalize this if you want to, but just for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to assume that the variation of the action is actually zero, the first variation of the action. And what this tells us, we get this Noether condition, which generically looks like this. These, remember, are the Euler expressions associated with the various fields, and their vanishing just gives you the Euler-Lagrange expressions. And these are the form variations of the fields. Plus, that'll be the bulk term, but we get a boundary term when you consider the integral, and this will be equal to, again, the sum over the fields. So that's the generic form of the Noether condition. And what we're interested in the case of a local symmetry, of course, this one doesn't move, does it? What we're interested in is form variations of the fields, which will be linear in some arbitrary function of the space-time derivatives, not arbitrary constant parameters, but now functions, because this makes it a local symmetry. So I'll write down AIK. So we have some function of space-time psi. So our variation in the fields will be linear in psi, but also, let's say, the first derivatives. So we have another term, BIK, nu psi k, derivative with respect to dx mu, and we're also going to write dx is equal to cik that's linear in these arbitrary fields plus dik nu . So this is just to say that we have a local symmetry that depend not on constant parameters, but on these arbitrary fields and their first derivatives. Now just plug this expression in here, and here, and this expression in here, here, and you get out some big complicated thing. And we saw that in the case of deriving Noether's second theorem, We choose the variations in such a way that this boundary term vanishes. You can always do that. And you get a certain identity. Remember this, I beg your pardon, this should be equal to zero. This is an identity. It just follows from this. And you'll recall that Noether's second theorem follows by choosing variations that make this vanish. And so you basically just use that term. And you get a certain linear combination of the Euler expressions is equal to a divergence of another linear combination of the Euler expressions. That's Noether's second theorem. But now let's play another game. Instead of choosing our variations that make the boundary term vanish, we leave both terms in. But we realize because the choice of the fields is arbitrary, we can make the coefficients in this expression of the fields vanish. We can make the coefficients of the first derivatives of the fields vanish. And we can make the coefficients of this, I beg your pardon, of the second derivatives of the fields vanish. Because there will be terms in here that depend on the second derivative of psi. Here, for example, we've got a derivative of the variation, and the variation already has a first derivative. So what do we get? We get three new identities. They're sometimes called the cascade equations. And these are very little known in the literature. So let me write down what they are. The first one is a familiar one, which is just EI AIK plus D mu J mu K equals zero. And that's just related to Noether's first theorem. Remember, we saw that this is the Noether current. And if all the fields are dynamical, that term vanishes, and we're left with a continuity equation. And that's just Noether's first theorem. But now we get, if we look at, if we make all the coefficients of the first derivatives of the field of the arbitrary function vanish, we get another interesting identity, which looks like this. Now it's a linear combination, a different linear combination of the Euler expressions, plus J K mu, plus d mu theta k nu nu. And this thing also is equal to zero. I'm not going to write down the expression for this term here, but it turns out that the identity associated with the vanishing of the coefficients of the second derivatives gives you that this term here is anti-symmetric in mu and u. And now we're just about there. Because what is this identity telling us? It's telling us that on shell, so if all these EIs vanish, the Noether current is equal to the divergence of an anti-symmetric object, which is a curl. So this is now, these two tell us that Jake, then the Noether current is equal to curl. So now when we calculate the divergence of a curl is identically zero, and we get something rather trivial out. So really, what I needed to do last week was introduce this second identity, these two further identities explicitly. And that's where the Noether third theorem comes from. Intuitively, think of it the following way. Suppose you have a theory that's written in, say, flat Minkowski spacetime, where you have field equations for some fields that are written in the standard Lorentzian coordinate systems, you know, the usual ones you use in special relativity, where you don't see any sign, for example, of the connection coefficients, because they vanish in those frames. So you just take the normal form of the field equations. And you don't see any explicit sign necessarily of, say, the geometrical objects like G mu nu or the connection coefficients. You get out in this theory a well-defined conservation principle that's associated with the vanishing of the divergence of the Noether current. But you say to yourself, well, what about Kretschmann's point? I can always make this theory generally covariant. I can always do that. But that means adding to the equations. If you want to express them in an arbitrary coordinate system, suddenly things like the connection coefficients are going to appear explicitly in the equations because you're forcing the theory to look generally covariant. They become more complicated. But nonetheless, now the theory has a local symmetry because it's generally covariant. And you say to yourself, how could I have lost? Because of Noether's third theorem, how could I have lost that conservation principle that held originally in the original formulation of the theory? I can't lose it. It doesn't go out of existence just because I make the theory generally covariant. And the reason that you don't lose it is the following. It's because when you go to the generally covariant case, those objects that you have to introduce, like the connection coefficients, into the field equations, are associated with an absolute background space-time structure, not a dynamical one. So there'll be EIs here that don't vanish associated with the background structure. Right? Minkowski space-time is not dynamical. G mu nu is not a dynamical object, and therefore, when it appears in the field equations, you do not apply Hamilton's principle to it. So there'll be some EIs here that don't vanish, which means the J, that original Noether current, which is conserved non-trivially, now is no longer equal just to a curl, because you've still got some of these terms hanging around. So everything's fine. Just
divergence free?
No, it's divergence free because of this identity.
But the EI won't be zero.
But the EI won't be zero, which means that this thing is not a curl.
So but also in the first line, the EI won't be zero.
Not all. Good point. Not all of the EI is zero, zero. But you remember that I mentioned that in order to get this is the first theorem, it's not required that all the EIs are zero here. It's sufficient that some of these, it's sufficient that in the cases where the EIs are not zero, the coefficients vanish. And that's precisely what happens in the Minkowski spacetime, because these turn out to be the Lie drags associated with the background metric field, and they're zero because you have Killing vectors. I'm glad you raised that point. It's precisely because you have symmetries in the spacetime that that term vanishes, but not that one. So it all sort of hangs together. I hope that was a little bit more helpful. I rushed over this far too quickly last week. I mean, if people have any questions about this, we can come back to them at the end of the session. So now, going from the sublime to the ridiculous, let's imagine, for example, well, something that you're absolutely aware of. If your elbow slips and you knock your glass of water onto the ground, the chances are that glass will break. And it will shatter into a number of pieces, and you've just witnessed a process that you will never in your whole life ever see the reverse of. You can wait as long as you like, but you will never see shards of glass surrounded in some kind of liquid on the floor spontaneously coming together and forming a cup and jumping onto the desk with all the liquid still in it. Now, why is that? Aren't the fundamental laws of physics time reversal invariant? Can you think of one fundamental law in physics that's not time reversal invariant? Well, one has to be a little bit careful here. But let's say the main ones, and certainly the ones that are concerned with the fundamental physics basically going on inside the structure of the glass and the liquid and so on. So we do have a problem here, and this problem has been acute and well recognized ever since the early days of the kinetic theory of gases. How do you get something in the kinetic theory of gases, for example, when you try to understand, you're trying to give a mechanical underpinning to heat and work, temperature, and so on? How do you end up getting something that looks a little bit like the second law of thermodynamics? And incidentally, in thermodynamics, what I really mean by this, if you ask for what is the seat of irreversibility in thermodynamics, it is not really the second law. The seat of irreversibility in classical thermodynamics is the following assumption that's usually implicit in every single textbook on thermodynamics, but perhaps should be raised to the level of a law. In fact, some people have referred to it as the minus first law. But after all, you have a zeroth law in thermodynamics, and you run out of space. So it's sometimes referred to as the minus first law. What is the minus first law? It is the following claim. If you have an isolated system, and you find it outside of equilibrium, it will spontaneously approach equilibrium and stay there forever. So the very notion of equilibrium in thermodynamics is time asymmetric. Unless you make that assumption, you can't even get the ball rolling in thermodynamics. Okay, now, what the second law tells you is that in these processes where a system outside of equilibrium is approaching equilibrium, the second law of thermodynamics doesn't explain that spontaneous approach. It doesn't account for it. In fact, there's no explanation of thermodynamics. It's just a fundamental postulate. But what the second law of thermodynamics tells you is what's going to happen if that does happen. That's to say, in entropic terms, the second law of thermodynamics tells you that with certain kinds of irreversible processes, you're going to find an increase of entropy. I'm skimming over a whole lot of subtleties here. But let's say what we want to do in the kinetic theory of gases, we want to understand why, if we create a gas in a state that's outside of equilibrium, why does it approach equilibrium irreversibly and stay there forever? That's the problem. But we have to bear in mind that the fundamental laws of collision say, inside the gas, a time reversal invariant. So that's our challenge. So what I want to talk about today is Boltzmann's H theorem, which was developed in 1872, which was the beginning of the analysis of thermodynamic behavior of gases in a detailed fashion in the kinetic theory of gases. And what happened when people suddenly woke up to the fact that this theorem could not be true. It simply could not be true. It was too good to be true. And what I'm going to say today is based on some work that I've done since actually before I was here at PI, but largely during the process of being here at PI with Wayne Myhrvold, who, as you know, is a professor at the University of Western Ontario in the philosophy department. This is a picture of Boltzmann at roughly the time, this is a photo of Boltzmann at roughly the time he derived the H theorem. I think he was in his late 20s. And there were, shortly thereafter, a number of objections. In fact, Boltzmann's H theorem was really already inconsistent with the point of view of James Clerk Maxwell, who, of course, as you know, particularly by way of the discovery of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for gases, the equilibrium distribution, velocity distribution for gases, made extremely important contributions. Yeah, he lived a long time. Thanks. 1879. Unfortunately, he lived rather a short life. Maxwell had the following. Maxwell famously said at one stage, the validity of the second law of thermodynamics is of the following kind. If I take a tumblerful of water and I throw it into the sea, it's very, very difficult for me to find those molecules again. It's very, very improbable. And that's the nature of the improbability of a process involving a decrease in entropy. So to claim that entropy is either stationary or increases for certain kinds of adiabatic processes is only as probable as my not being able to find those same molecules again out of the sea. So he had, let's put it this way, a probabilistic underpinning always in mind in relation to the second law. And this is completely inconsistent with what Boltzmann was doing. And Maxwell had this picture well in mind before Boltzmann's work. Boltzmann, of course, had been reading Maxwell's work very carefully, but hadn't taken on board this probabilistic reading of thermodynamics that Maxwell had. Joseph Loschmidt, who was a mentor of Boltzmann when Boltzmann was a student, in 1876, that's to say just a few years after, in fact, I don't know why it took quite so long, but something like 4 or 5 years after the H theorem was published, Loschmidt published a couple of papers, they were very great friends, by the way, in which he pointed out that the theorem couldn't be true in its original form. And I'm going to go through all of this in some detail. Now, independently of Loschmidt, and some years later, Henri Poincaré and Ernst Zermelo came up with what's now sometimes referred to as the recurrence objection, which is really associated with the Poincaré recurrence theorem. If systems left to themselves are able only to move within a finite phase space, and they're conservative, then eventually a system will return as close as you like to its original state an infinite number of times. Now, if the H theorem is supposed to describe the increase of entropy of a system, how can it be that the system, and this is irreversible, how can it be that the system will recur? So this posed a problem for the H theorem, but it was of a completely different kind from the Loschmidt objection. What do these figures have in common? And in particular on the right-hand side, what do they all have in common? And no, I am not referring to the fact that they all were heavily bearded, as most scholars in the end of the 19th century seem to have been. Well, I think it's fair to say that all of these figures were very famous for other reasons. Maxwell, of course, because of Maxwellian electrodynamics and many other contributions. Loschmidt, it turns out, something I discovered only recently, was the first actually to calculate the Avogadro number. And it's sometimes called the Loschmidt number. Poincaré, well, what can one say about Poincaré? He was the giant of mathematics at the end of the 19th century. His contributions to both physics and mathematics were uncountable. Less well known is Ernst Zermelo, who is really more of a mathematician, but he, of course, developed a tremendous reputation in the foundations of set theory in mathematics. And you may have heard of the Zermelo-Frankel axioms of set theory. I don't know how old he was. He was very young when he was involved in this criticism of Boltzmann's H theorem. And in fact, his papers are extremely acute, well worth reading, much more acute than Poincaré's. And I don't know how old he was when he shifted basically into pure mathematics, when he left physics, or whether he continued to do any physics. So let me just give a quick account of the H theorem. I'm not going to sketch its proof, but I'm going to just give you a sense of how it works. Suppose we take a gas of monatomic particles. Let's suppose they're just perfect spheres, all of the same kind, all of the same mass, just for simplicity. We put them into a box that has ideally reflecting walls. Okay? We're assuming the gas is so dilute that only binary conditions count. We're not interested in the very, very rare cases, for example, of three particles colliding. We're just interested in binary collision, so it's a relatively dilute gas. We are also assuming, by the way, that we don't start with the gas in a condition where all the molecules are moving uniformly in straight lines in the same direction and bouncing back and forth between opposite walls. That system will never equilibrate. Of course, it's highly idealized. But you can easily imagine the tiniest deviation from the ideal nature of the walls is going to create at least one collision, and then all hell will break loose. And in 10 to the minus 7 of a second, the gas will equilibrate. So we're not considering that very idealized case. We're considering the case where we actually do have collisions. Now, let's write down a distribution function that tells me how many molecules in this gas at a given time have a position that's localized around r, the vector r, with respect to some coordinate system, that's localized around the velocity v at time t. That's the distribution function, okay? Or you might call it a density function. And we're going to assume straight away, again for simplicity, that the gas is spatially homogeneous. You know, sometimes when we're talking about the problem of the arrow of time, we love to talk about pushing the gas right up to the corner of the box and then waiting to see what happens, and explaining why the gas irreversibly fills the box and that's it. We're not interested in that case now. Just for simplicity, we're assuming that the gas is uniformly distributed in the container. We're really only interested in the distribution of velocities in the H theorem. So that we can ignore the R. And we're also only interested in the case where the velocities have an isotropic distribution. So we're not interested in the vectorial form of the V. We can just write down V, the absolute value of the velocity. So we're not interested in the directions, just in the absolute value of the velocities. Now, what we're also looking at, we're assuming that there are no external forces acting on the box. So really what we're looking at is how the F changes by way of collisions, and it's roughly the equation that Boltzmann came up with is sometimes called a balance equation. Okay, so this F will change merely a result of collisions, not the result of any external actions on the gas. Now there's a very important assumption that was made by Boltzmann. He was not the first to introduce it. Maxwell and Clausius had already been introducing this assumption. In fact, it looks so obvious that Boltzmann didn't even name it in his 1872 paper. Didn't even name it. He didn't pick it aside and saying, note that I am making the following assumption. He just introduced it straight away. And that's the assumption that if you want to know the distribution for the velocity of pairs of molecules just before a collision, that is the same as the distribution function for velocities, the product of the distributions for the velocities of the individual pair of particles. What does that mean? It means that just before collisions, the velocities of the particles are uncorrelated. There's a kind of randomness in the magnitude of the velocities just before collisions. So this is sometimes referred to as the Stott-Salanzsatz. I'm sure I pronounced that badly. Sometimes referred to as SZA, or sometimes referred to as the collisions assumption, or sometimes referred to as molecular chaos. Although one should really be careful about talking about molecular chaos, because in 1911, in the great review paper on all of this stuff that the Ehrenfests wrote, they reserved the term molecular chaos for something else, for a statistical version of this. But anyway, this is an assumption that goes in. There is no indication in 1872 that Boltzmann thought of this as an assumption, as a hypothesis. It seemed to him an absolutely natural state of the gas. Well, if you then introduce this functional, which is the integral of f log f for the single, this distribution function for the single molecules, single atoms, you can consider this to be the negative of the entropy. Why? Because if this SZA assumption, this molecular collisions assumption, holds at all times, it's straightforward to show that the time derivative of H is less than or equal to zero, so therefore H will either stay the same or will decrease at all times because of collisions. And that's the H theorem. So this functional H is going to either stay stationary or decrease because of collisions, but monotonically. That's to say, this is an irreversible process. Now, the point that I want to start by making is the following. There's some discussion about this in the literature. I mean, it's not an altogether straightforward issue. But I'm going to claim that there's no need to treat this distribution function probabilistically. This is a tricky point. Boltzmann himself used the word probability when he referred to this density function. It's the probability that a given particle chosen randomly, as it were, its velocity will lie in a certain tiny range around V. But actually, it's really a question of counting. If you're given a finite gas, you can ask God, if you have some kind of direct telephone line with the divine, how many molecules in fact do have velocities in that range. It's just a fact of the matter, what that F is. It's got nothing to do with probabilistic reasoning. You could say that it has to do, of course, with statistics, but I want to make a distinction between statistics and probabilities, conceptual distinction, and I'll come back to this later. In other words, you might say, well, look, this thing here is a correlation assumption. It means there are no correlations in the velocities of particles just about to collide. Surely the notion of correlation is statistical. I grant you that. But really what's going on here is a sophisticated extension of the notion of just mere counting. Remember, we're talking about a single gas. Here's another way of putting the point. All of this makes perfect sense without ever referring to an infinite ensemble. You see the point? All of this makes entirely good conceptual sense in relation to a single gas with a finite number of molecules. You don't need to refer to some hypothetical infinite ensemble of gases to make sense of this. Now, some people have worried about this a little bit because actually it turns out that Boltzmann assumed that F would be continuous, that H was differentiable, and so on and so forth. And people say, well, what, you know, since this is really only a finite number of molecules, he's really putting in some hidden probabilistic notions and so on. But that's not the way Boltzmann himself thought of it. He didn't think of it that way. He thought, just given the fact that there's a large number of molecules, 10 to whatever it is, 23, we can just treat this thing as a smooth function. But that was just an approximation. There wasn't anything conceptually profound going on here. Now, what were the objections? Well, pretty obviously, something has gone badly wrong. First of all, Loschmidt made this very simple remark. Suppose that you have a phase of the gas that's outside of equilibrium, so it has high H value, or equivalently a low entropy. The H theorem tells you that in the next period of time, as long as this SZA assumption is true at all intervening times, during some interval, future interval, the H will decrease monotonically. The entropy, therefore, will increase. But what if at the end of the process, you took that gas and miraculously changed the sign of all the velocities? Now, what would happen in the future? Well, because the equations of motion of the collisions are time reversal invariant, the system is going to merely retrace its steps. If you think of it as a point in the phase space of the gas, the curve will just retrace itself. I'm not talking about something going backwards in time. I'm talking about just ordinary motion in the same temporal direction. But since we've changed the velocity of all the molecules, the equations of motion, which are time reversal invariant, will tell us that the system will retrace its steps. Doesn't that mean the H functional itself doesn't depend on the sign of the velocities. It's invariant. So therefore, the H function is now going to increase. But if I reverse the velocities of a gas, isn't that still a possible state of the gas? Of course it is. So I've just given you a process in which the H function will increase rather than decrease. I beg your pardon? Of course.
Or it could stay the same.
Of course. Or it could stay the same. Of course, you're absolutely right. But nonetheless, this is a counterexample to the theorem. Because irregardless of how you don't have to do a calculation in this case. And it doesn't rely on the yesterday being true. It's simply the fact that if I have a process in which H is decreasing, in principle, by inverting the sign of all the molecules at the last point, now the system, again moving forwards in time, will simply retrace its steps. I don't need to appeal to the H there, the SLA. We'll have to do this because of the time reversal invariance of the equations. That's the so-called reversibility objection. Notice it requires this very strong principle, I'm going to call it reversibility, that the equations of motion are time reversal invariant. If you put t goes to minus t inside the equations, which means, of course, that p goes to minus p, you may have to adjust certain other parameters as well, certain other variables, but nonetheless, you get the same equations of motion. So nothing in the fundamental dynamics of the collisions is picking out a direction in time. That's the notion of reversibility I want to stress. And this is what the reversibility objection presupposes. Now, independently of Loschmidt, oh, and by the way, Boltzmann, as early as 1877, already had a reply. He replied straight away to Loschmidt and introduced some probabilistic notions, and I'll come back to those. So there was a change. There was a change in Boltzmann's thinking, but he was a little bit disingenuous. Because when he introduced some probabilistic notions so as to get around the Loschmidt objection, he referred to the fact that originally in his paper, he used the word probability. But he used the word probability in relation to the definition of the density function. Completely different notion. And I've been arguing that that notion doesn't really intrinsically have a probabilistic meaning. So something very important happened, a change in his thinking occurred, although he tried to hide it a little bit. Now, independently of Loschmidt, the English physicist Culverwell, or British physicist, I don't know where he came from exactly, wrote a letter to Nature in 1894, so this is quite some years later. He had been looking at a proof of the H theorem by a man called Watson and said, well, wait a minute, something's gone badly wrong here. How can this H theorem proof be valid when you can reverse the velocities of all the molecules? In other words, he came up independently of, it must have occurred to many people that this couldn't be right. The Loschmidt objection must have occurred independently to many people. Culver was one of them. Now, the interesting thing about this debate was that it brought in people like Burberry, Larmor, Boltzmann himself, a number of people. But it was Burberry's work. Burberry had also published a version of the H theorem. And Burberry was the first to point out clearly what the role of the SZA was, that collisions assumption. That had never been clarified before. He also showed, by the way, Burberry also showed that if the SZA holds before the collisions, and if you imagine looking after the collisions and looking in the backwards temporal direction, so now it's these particles that have just collided now look as if they're about to collide. If the SZA holds for those, in other words, it holds in both temporal directions, the system must be in equilibrium. This is the first time that anyone proved this. And Burberry said this is a condition for the very consistency of the H theorem. So the first person to show that the Stotzhal-Ansatz is not symmetric in time was Burberry. Now, there's already something time-isometric about the SZA because it refers to pre-collision velocities, not post-collision velocities. There's something already asymmetric in it. But Burberry further showed that it couldn't apply in both temporal directions before and after a given set of collisions without the system already being in equilibrium. Well, Boltzmann came back. He entered into the Nature debate. He published two papers in Nature, 1894 and I think 1895, in which he again picked up something he'd already said in 1877, which surprisingly none of the contributors to the Nature debate seemed to be aware of, namely that actually the H theorem wasn't strictly valid, it was only probabilistically true. So Boltzmann stressed something he'd been saying since 1877 that nobody seemed to have realized, that he'd already given up on the original form of the H theorem. Good. But now, what I really want to concentrate on today a little bit more is the recurrence objection. It's different in kind, and its proposers had a very different, it seems to me, had a very different agenda. And this is something that surprised me when I looked into it. Because normally, when you read about this account in the literature, you see, well, you know, there were two different kinds of objections. There was the reversibility objection, there was the recurrence objection. They're doing slightly different work, but they're just two sides of the same coin. what is it that these guys were doing? They were basically saying, look, it's not that the kinetic theory of gases, the whole approach, mechanical approach to heat is wrong. It's just that Boltzmann has overdone it. He's overcooked his result in the terms of the original 1872 H theorem. It's too strong. Clearly something has to give. But it's not that the whole program of giving a mechanical underpinning of heat and thermodynamic processes and thermodynamic behavior is somehow misguided from the beginning. Well, was that the case for these guys, Poincaré and Zermelo? Now, Poincaré famously, I mean, normally the recurrence theorem is associated with the name of Zermelo in 1896. It's not that well known that Poincaré himself had a number of objections to the kinetic theory of gases that predate this. And in fact, he was the first person himself, or he was the first person in 1893 who actually used the recurrence theorem, his own recurrence theorem, as an objection. Now recall, the recurrence theorem was published in 1890. And this was part of Poincaré's great work on celestial dynamics. He proved the recurrence theorem in 1890. And in 1893, he wrote an article as if to philosophers. It was published in the Reviews of Metaphysics. And it's written in a very informal style. And he's basically saying, look, the kinetic theory of gases is in trouble because of the recurrence theorem. But actually, the nature of the paper is rather obscure. He actually said, well, wait a minute. Maybe it's okay if you adopt the Maxwellian notion that the H theorem, he doesn't refer to the H theorem explicitly, but if you adopt the idea that the second law of thermodynamics is only probabilistic, then maybe you can make sense of the recurrence theorem. But he still didn't like it. And his paper is very ambiguous because he gives a concession. He says it's only the probabilistic accounts of the, what he calls the English philosophers. The English have this probabilistic account of the second law of thermodynamics. Well, it's really horrible. This whole kinetic theory has seduced the minds of very great men, he says at one stage. But at least if you introduce a probabilistic element, you have a chance of success. Because you can see a way in which the universe might evolve at least at first sight thermodynamically, but eventually when it hits equilibrium, if you wait long enough, he says, if you have a little bit of patience, the thing is going to jump out of equilibrium again because the system has to recur. Of course, he was perfectly aware that the times involved were staggeringly large. I think for a typical little gas, if you take a gas and put it slightly out of equilibrium, just for a typical gas, say in an enclosure of, you know, the order of magnitude of a meter or maybe a centimeter, I'm not quite sure. I mean, these times, these recurrence times are staggeringly large, 10 to the 10 to the 19 or something. I mean, they're hugely large in the age of the universe. So what we're looking at here is not a pragmatic difficulty, it's a logical difficulty with respect to the H theorem. But what was his agenda? What was Poincaré's agenda? Well, and what was Zermelo's agenda? And so I want to go through some of the details of the recurrence theorem, assuming that we've all understood the nature of the reversibility objection. What I propose to do is just say one or two more things about Poincaré and Zermelo, and we'll have a very quick break, and I'll come back quickly to Boltzmann, and then we can just open it for discussion. I want to make a distinction, therefore, between invertibility and reversibility. Now, I've mentioned let's put things into rather more modern formalism. We have a phase space lambda, and we consider a point in the phase space as representing the instantaneous spatial configuration of all the molecules and their instantaneous velocities. So this is just a familiar phase space in statistical mechanics, and we're interested in a flow on the phase space, a Hamiltonian type flow, which means that if we know the point, we can calculate the orbit through that point. And so we get the flow, there'll exist a flow T that depends on some parameter T that takes points in the space into other points depending on this single parameter. And we're going to assume that it satisfies the semi-group property, which means that T of T plus S is equal to T of T plus T of S, not T of S. It's the so-called semi-group property of the flow. So I'm just abstracting out this notion of some kind of Hamiltonian flow on the phase space. And we're going to assume, and this is just the generalization of the Liouville theorem for the Hamiltonian situation standardly in the kinetic theory of gases, we're going to assume that there's a measure on the phase space, which means that there is a sigma algebra of subsets of the phase space, which I'll call curly A. Each one of these subsets has a definite value associated with this measure function. So it maps these into the real line. And we're going to assume that it is preserved under the flow. What does that mean? It means that mu of T of some set, some subset, measurable subset of points in the phase space is equal to mu of A. So just consider a blob, some kind of original blob representing possible states of our gas. Every point in there represents an instantaneous state of the gas. Imagine this thing evolving over time, all the points evolving over time. If you think of the typical dynamics as being mixing, you know very well that this little blob is going to start to develop tendrils that go all over the place. But the total volume in the future is exactly the same as the original volume. And that's just a generalization of the Liouville theorem. Now, we normally assume, in conjunction with the notion that we're generalizing Hamiltonian flow, that this has an inverse. In other words, this flow on the phase space is one-to-one. Okay, I'm going to call that invertibility. So the T has an inverse. In the case of the reversibility objection, that's not enough. You need a further constraint, which is this one here. If you invert, if you go back to the situation where we have the phase points are given by the instantaneous configuration at time t is equal to zero of all the molecules and their instantaneous velocities, and we allow under the flow for this to develop into this new point in the phase space, we're assuming that if you invert the signs of the momenta or the velocities, if this flows into that, I beg your pardon, if this is the result of the flow acting on an original point, then we get back, if we change at the end of that process the positions of all the signs of all the molecules, we're going to again, after the same amount of time, we're going to get back the original configuration, except that the velocities are opposite. In other words, the system will retrace its steps. And this is what I call reversibility. Now, again, this is just another way of talking about the claim that the equations of motion are time reversal invariant, as they are in Hamiltonian dynamics, standard Hamiltonian dynamics. So I want to make a distinction here between reversibility and invertibility. Reversibility is a much stronger condition.
On your symmetry.
It's a symmetry of the dynamics. It's the symmetry of the dynamical equations of motion.
Yeah.
They are form invariant under the transformation t goes to minus t. And that's much stronger than invertibility. Interestingly, the recurrence theorem requires neither. The reversibility condition requires both. The recurrence theorem requires neither. In that sense, it's much stronger. I'm just going to mention very quickly, there was a nice, in 18, before Poincaré himself, before Poincaré had discovered the recurrence theorem in celestial dynamics, he was already worried about attempts to prove something like a second law of thermodynamics in the kinetic theory of gases. And what he said was, you cannot have a function on the phase space, some positive valued function on the phase space, which is constantly increasing, or in other words, is monotonically increasing, or non-decreasing, better point. You just can't have that on measure theoretic grounds. His argument wasn't very nice. Zermelo gave a much better version of his argument, which does not require the recurrence result. So I'm just going to mention this briefly. There's quite a nice way of ruling out an entropy type function, which is non-decreasing, if the phase space has finite volume, finite measure. So we're thinking, for example, of a gas that's confined in a finite region of space and its energy is bounded from above. Okay? Now, what Zermelo said was basically the following. Take an arbitrary measurable set of points, little g, just an arbitrary measurable set of points, no matter how small. And consider the union of all of its time developments. So you can imagine that after some period of time, little t, this thing will evolve into another shape. Of course, its volume is being preserved. And then after another time, t, it further evolves. And you take the union of all those time developments. Take the union of all those time developments. Call that big G. Now, big G, for all finite times. So it's as it were all the future points in the phase space that will be visited by these points. All the points in the phase space that will be visited in the future, in the totally extended future, by those points. Now, we know that the volume of that set is still finite because the volume of the entire phase space is finite. And then we define the following integral, assuming that this S function, this entropy function is integrable, we define it as the integral of S over the time evolution of that set itself. It takes a bit of thinking about this. You take the future entire set of little g, and you consider its temporal evolution under the flow for each little finite period of t. Well, it turns out that S, this integral here, must be non-decreasing by the very definition of S. It must be non-decreasing. But if you think about it, this can't be true because this object here is actually contained in G, this thing, and because of the measure-preserving nature of the flow. We have a contradiction. It takes a bit of thinking about. It's not entirely obvious. But it's a nice argument to the effect that if you want to define a positive function, a single-valued function on the phase space that gives you the entropy of that particular configuration of the gas, and you make the assumption that it's forever non-decreasing, you're going to end up with a contradiction as long as the measure of the phase space is finite. We haven't appealed to the recurrence theorem here. We've appealed to something close to it, but we haven't appealed to the actual recurrence theorem. Now, notice here, by the way, that something is going on that's related to the original H theorem, which is very non-thermodynamical to start with. And what is that? In thermodynamics, the entropy is a state parameter. The very existence of a state parameter that has the properties of entropy is a consequence of the second law of thermodynamics. It's a consequence of the claim that if you have a cyclic process in the phase space, sorry, if you have a cyclic process involving quasi-static changes, like a Carnot cycle, you cannot convert a certain input of heat from, let's say, a reservoir totally into work in that cycle. This is the Kelvin version of the second law of thermodynamics. It's the claim that you can't create a perpetual motion machine of a certain kind, the so-called second kind. From that, it follows there exists a state function S associated with each equilibrium state of the system, which is non-decreasing for adiabatic processes. But remember that in thermodynamics, the entropy is only defined for equilibrium states. It is not defined for states of the system outside of equilibrium. But here, we're assuming that the existence of this function S, which, like the Boltzmann H functional, is defined for all states. We're doing something very non-thermodynamical here. And you might say, well, I don't really like this. If we're trying to get out something, if we're trying to get out something that looks like the second law of thermodynamics, we should be careful about not assigning entropy to states of systems outside of equilibrium. Boltzmann has already done this. So I'm just saying, if you have doubts along those lines, you're not going to be satisfied with this proof. But if you're happy with the notion of an H theorem, where the H function, the negative of the entropy, is defined for any states in the phase space, then this is going to be a problem for you. You're not going to be able to accept this is a violation of the H theorem. Okay. Now, very quickly, I'm just going to go through the recurrence theorem, and then we'll come back and see how Poincaré and Zermelo used this theorem. Now, this is something that no doubt is familiar to you. Suppose, again, that we have this generic dynamical system, which is a combination of the phase space, the Borel set of measurable subsets, of the a Borel sigma algebra of subsets of the phase space, and a measure U defined on those subsets. And we have a measure that's preserved by a certain flow, which represents the time evolution of the states of the system inside the phase space. And we assume, furthermore, that the total measure of the phase space is finite. Those are the conditions of the theorem. Then it turns out that the recurrence theorem goes like this. Take your arbitrary set of points here. Allow some time for all of those points to leave. Let's imagine we have some finite time at which all of the points inside that set have left the set. Let's call that tau. Okay? Then the set of points inside G, whose further temporal development after time tau, after they've left that set, never brings them back into the set, has measure zero. In other words, for all but a set of measure zero of states inside our original blob, for all but a set of measure zero, the points, even if they leave the set after time tau, will return to the original set an infinite number of times. That's the recurrence theorem. Are you familiar with this? You must have heard of this theorem. This is the 1890 recurrence theorem. And of course, it's going to create problems for the H theorem. And I just want to mention two things. The first, the proof does not require reversibility or even invertibility. It doesn't even require that the flow is one-to-one. But it does require the semi-group property. So it requires very, very weak conditions on the flow. It's amazingly general. The real work is being done by the fact that the two things, the measure of the entire space is finite, and the flow preserves the measure, which is a measure-preserving flow, so you have some generalization of the Liouville theorem. And secondly, that there's a quantum mechanical version of the theorem. But it wasn't actually published, although it's rather obvious in hindsight, it wasn't actually published until 1957. But notice one important thing. It doesn't tell you that every single point inside that set is going to recur an infinite number of times or even once. It tells you that every point up to a set of measure zero. So there will be non-recurring orbits in the phase space. There will be. Definitely will be non-recurring orbits. I'll tell you what it is. I'll say a little bit more about it. It looks very different. In the form of the theorem is very different. So I just want to stress there will be recurring orbits in the phase space. Why are they not interesting? Why couldn't they be exactly the ones that Boltzmann's talking about with the H there? Well, the standard answer is because they have measure zero. Well, what does that mean? What is the connection between this and probability? So insofar as this is an objection to the H theorem, something rather subtle is going on. You need to introduce what are essentially probabilistic notions, which haven't occurred so far. Because you have to make some connection between the measure of these sets and their, in some sense of the word, their likelihood. And here, things get very tricky. And by the way, this particular difficulty doesn't occur in the quantum mechanical version of the H theorem. So if I'd like to stop there for, let's say, 10 minutes. I'll finish my remarks about the Poincaré-Zermelo objection and Boltzmann's reply to all of this, and then we can have discussion.